Yeah, I just wanted to continue. We were discussing the Brisbane Apsarim. And this is what the covenant among the parts. And this is an extremely important part of the Torah, because this is where Avraham Avinu is informed that there will be a slavery and a servitude, and that is the cost, right? That is the cost of Eretz Yisrael. Gamis of the right, that the cost of Eretz Yisrael is that your children will have to be enslaved in a land that is not theirs. So we were discussing a few points that the Rambam uses the Brisbane Apsarim as a springboard for discussing the problem of Bechira, right? In Hilchos Tshuva, the Rambam develops the idea of free will and free choice, and the Rambam, of course, tells us that if a person would be born to either be a righteous person or a rasha, it wouldn't be possible for Hashem to punish him, because how could I be punished if Hashem made me do bad things? And it wouldn't be possible to reward a person. Why should Hashem reward me if I have to do what I'm doing? You know, you don't take out your computer for an ice cream or whatever it is. The computer just did what it was programmed to do. So the Rambam uses Brisbane Apsarim, however, to raise a lot of questions. We discussed some general questions the Rambam had about Bechira. How do you reconcile Bechira with Hashem knowing the future? Right? We talked about that. But then the Rambam raises a very specific question, and that is, if you're telling me everybody has free will, and without free will you cannot be punished, how do we understand when Hashem tells Abraham that your people will be enslaved by a nation that is not theirs for 400 years, and then I will punish that nation? If Hashem decreed that the Egyptians would enslave the Jewish people, then how could Hashem then say, I'm going to punish the Egyptians for doing so? By the way, don't confuse this with another question. The question of hardening Paro's heart is a different question. That's based on a pasuk in Bo. This is asking a question based on the covenant of the parts, where Hashem said, you will be enslaved by a nation that is not yours and a land that is not your land, and then I will punish that nation. If God decreed that this nation will enslave them, how could they be punished? So here the Rambam gives a very interesting answer, a very unusual answer. The Ramban argues with it. The Rambam says, Hashem did not decree that the nation had to be the Egyptian nation. Hashem said, a nation will enslave you. In other words, it is God's plan that some nation enslave. But every individual Egyptian, first of all, the nation of Egypt, and every individual Egyptian, didn't have to be the one to carry it out. Now, it's true that if the Egyptians would have been tzaddikim, some other nation would have done the same thing. But since HaKadosh Baruch Hu did not decree that this particular nation should do the enslavement, any bad thing the Egyptians did were a result of their own personal, individual, autonomous decision. And since it was a result of their autonomous decision, they can be punished and accountable for it, because HaKadosh Baruch Hu's gezerah, God's decree, was not machriach. It did not force any individual Egyptian to be a slave. Now, the Ramban doesn't like this answer, because the Ramban and the Ravid also, because they basically say, well, okay, let's say that God did not decree, did not order that any single Egyptian do anything bad. But God did say the Jewish people should be enslaved, so any Egyptian that's doing it is doing God's will. Meaning, even if you say, that's a different question though, in other words, even if you say that God's decree does not interfere with the free will of the actor, but if the free will of the actor is carrying out God's decree, why should there be punishment? That's the Ramban's kasha. But that's not the Rambam's answer is an answer for the Rambam's question. Meaning, again, the Rambam's question is, you didn't have free will if God decreed that it will be done. The answer is, God didn't decree that you're going to be the one who does it. Therefore, you have free will. Ramban is raising a question. Okay, you have free will, but you're carrying out a divine decree. Why should you be punished? So on this, the Ramban, so that's why I'm suggesting that The Ramban is not arguing with the Rambam's answer. The Ramban is simply giving a supplementation to the Rambam's answer. The Rambam says that God's decree does not interfere with free will because God didn't decree you have to do it. God just decreed it will be done, but not that you have to do it. But Ramban's question is, okay, but if God decreed it has to be done, then what moral thing am I doing wrong by doing it? That's a different question. It's important to know that's a different question. So on this, Ramban says two suggestions, both of which are very interesting. First, Ramban says that the issue of motivation is very, very important, and only Hashem knows motivation. And that is, the Egyptians enslaved the Jewish people, not in order to carry out God's decree. They did it out of their own selfishness or their own sadistic impulses. And therefore, even if what you're doing is carrying out God's decree, if your motivation in doing so is not to carry out the Ratzon Hashem, but for your own selfish reasons, Hashem will hold you accountable. That's actually a very important thing, which means even if in a sense the Jewish people had to be enslaved, because that was HaKadosh Baruch Hu's decree, that's not why the Egyptians were doing it. If it's not why the Egyptians were doing it, Hashem is going to treat it as their own sinful act. That is one answer the Ramban gives. A second answer the Ramban gives is that although Hashem decreed that the Jewish people would be enslaved and persecuted, but the Egyptians did more than that decree, meaning to say Hashem decreed X amount, but the Egyptians, by killing the babies and the like, did more than X amount. So Hashem holds them to account for more than X. Of course, the question, it's not so easy to understand. The question is, how would the Egyptians know? I mean, let's imagine, this is hypothetical, you had an Egyptian who 100% wanted to carry out only the will of God. Well, how would they know what is X amount and what is more than X amount? Now, as Hashem said, they will be enslaved and persecuted. So the Ramban says they did more than Hashem decreed. Okay. Well, how do you know how much Hashem decreed? I mean, there was not an exact quantification there. But these are the two answers the Ramban gives. Now, the Rambam then asks a third question. In other words, we talked about the conflict between Hashem knowing the future and Bechira, and then we have the question of the Bris Ben Absarim. Then the Rambam asks a third question about Hashem hardening Paro's heart, because here, you're not going to be able to give the answer. In the Bris Ben Absarim, we can say, Hashem did not affect the Bechira of an individual. That's true. But there's one individual whose Bechira seems to have been affected, and that one was the king of the country, when it says that Paro would have sent out the Jewish people, but Hashem hardened Paro's heart. Now there, you can't give the Rambam's answer of the Bris Ben Absarim, that Hashem didn't decree that a particular person enslaved the Jewish people, because Hashem did harden Paro's heart. Right? That's a separate question. Don't confuse it with the Bris Ben Absarim question. So here, the Rambam gives us, again, a very yesodistic answer. The Rambam says, we do know that all Averos have punishments. Sometimes the punishment is Olam Haba, maybe most of the time. Sometimes the punishment might be in Olam Hazeh. Right? There are punishments. There's accountability. A punishment could involve death, God forbid. A punishment could involve loss of functioning, loss of limb, loss of vision. So the Rambam says, the same way punishments can involve loss of function, a punishment can involve loss of free will, which is man's most valuable function. So the Rambam points out, the phrase, Hashem hardened Paro's heart, does not appear for the first five plagues. In other words, when there were plagues, blood and frogs and the kinim are the lice and the orov and the wild animals and the dever and the pestilence that killed the animals and the shechin and the boils. But for the first five, right? Dam, Tzvardeya, Kinim, Arov, Dever. For the first five, it says Paro hardened his heart. Paro intentionally rebelled against Hashem. So the Rambam says the punishment that was decreed against Paro was that because of his repeated bechira against Hashem, Hashem took away his bechira so that he would continue to be punished by further plagues as opposed to doing tshuva and sending them away. But the Rambam says that is not a contradiction to the free will principle. That is simply recognizing that in extreme cases, a Kodesh Baruch Hu takes away free will as a punishment for the averos that a person commits. Now let me give, and then Hashem could punish you for the averos that you're doing without free will. An example. Let me give you an example that may illustrate this. Let's take a person who drives an automobile when they're drunk, and because they're drunk, they kill somebody. Now, you know, you can obviously go to jail for that. Driving while intoxicated, driving under the influence of alcohol or drugs, and you kill somebody, that can be a very serious crime. You can be tried for murder, even. Now, the question that you can raise is, well, wait a second here. When I drove into that person and killed them, I had no intention to kill them. There was no free will. I did not choose to hurt them. Why should I be punished so severely? Let it just be an accident. The answer is that even though the final act you committed was in a sense involuntary, it is the product of the voluntary act of taking in the alcohol and the drugs which caused you to lose control over your actions. And therefore, you are accountable even for actions over which you had no control, because it was your choice that put you in this situation where you had no control. You had control over making the choice that put you in the point beyond return. So, this is a pretty good analogy. And that is, it is true that by the last five plagues, when Paro was not letting the Jewish people out, he had no control over his actions. Even if he wanted to let them go, Hashem was making his heart feel, I won't do it, and I can't do it. So how could he be punished for decisions which were beyond his control? The Rambam's answer is, he put himself in a place where decisions were beyond his control by all of the decisions he made to rebel against Hashem. He made himself a drug addict. In fact, one might even understand the Rambam as saying, Paro became addicted to intransigence. He reached a point of no return for which he is accountable because he put himself in that very situation. You can actually look at it as a form of spiritual addiction. The same way you can be addicted to drugs, you can be addicted to power, you can be addicted to the notion that you're not going to surrender. You know, they have these Japanese soldiers. I think some of them are still fighting World War II. I don't know, probably not now, but I do remember like they were given an order in 1945 like to never surrender, you know, to the Americans. And you know, some guy was hiding in the forest, so like, you know, it's 2010, never surrender. You know, he's 95 years old, and he becomes addicted to this idea, even if it makes no sense anymore. And that's what the Rambam says. Okay, so that's right. So the Rambam has the kasha of the Bris Ben Absarim, and for that he answered, Hashem didn't decree on any particular person. Again, Hashem hardening Paro's heart is a consequence of Paro's own rebellion against Hashem. By the way, the Maral gives another answer to Hashem hardening Paro's heart. And interestingly enough, the Maral's answer is based on something else the Rambam says, not about free will. That is, you know, one of the problems that the Jewish people face is that, again, maybe we'll give a shiur on this sometimes, is the problem of an aguna, right? An aguna basically means a stranded woman, an anchored woman. Husband refuses to give her a get, right? Even though the Beis Din ordered him to give a get, he refuses. Now, in Eretz Yisrael, the Maisa, because the Batei Din are part of the state governmental apparatus of courts, if a man refuses to give a get, he can go to jail in Eretz Yisrael. He can lose his driver's license, he can have his passport confiscated, he can have his bank account frozen. So Lamaisa, in Eretz Yisrael, things can be done, but the truth is, even here, you know, people go to jail. they don't always want to give a get. In America, there's much less that can be done. In America, If a basin orders a man to give a get, and the man doesn't do it, what do? Say you have a Facebook rally, you put his picture in the Jewish press. There's really not a tremendous amount that can be done. I think this is a big problem. But here is the thing. According to the Gemara, once Basin has paskin that a man must give a get, a man can be beaten until he says he's willing to give a get. Now, this is a big question, because normally if a get is obtained by force or coercion, it is not a valid get. So if a get that is obtained by force or coercion is not a valid get, then how could there be a rule that if based in paskins, he could be beaten until he says he wants? It's almost like a joke. You can't give a get unless you want, but we beat you until you say you want. You have to say the words like, uncle, I want to give a get. Do you want to give a get? Put a gun to his head. Yes, I want to give a get. We have to hear those words. But the Rambam says, obviously he doesn't want to give a get. He's giving a get because there's a gun to his head. How can that be valid? So the Rambam himself says a very interesting psychological idea. He says, deep inside your neshama, every Jewish neshama, the real desire is to listen to Hashem's halacha. And if I don't listen to Hashem's halacha, that's because the Yetzer Hara makes it more attractive for me not to. So when the basin puts the gun to my head, they're basically removing the attraction of not keeping the din. So when I say yes, it's not yes because of the gun. It's yes because that is my true will, with the distraction of the Yetzer Hara being removed by the fear of the gun. Now, that's why it only works. Let me point out, it only works when a Beis Din has said you're chayev to give a get. Until a Beis Din has said you're chayev, that's why people make mistakes. Sometimes women say, hey, the Gemara says you can just beat up a guy, so why can't I hire goons to beat up a guy? You have to understand, if Beis Din did not yet paskin, the man has to give a get, then hiring goons would be an invalid get. It would be a coercive get. Goons can be hired only once a Beis Din paskin. Now, by the way, I don't mean the Beis Din has to paskin that you can use goons. You know, you don't need them to even say it. They could close their eyes, and it's advisable for them to close their eyes. But once they paskin he's chayav, the woman is entitled to do whatever she can do. As you know, this is actually literally a federal case in New York. That's correct. Very questionable. There were three rabbis, actually, I think I know two of them. There were three rabbis that for $20,000 or $30,000, they guaranteed a woman a get. And they had used cattle prods and electrodes and all sorts of things. And they got these gittin for the women. But, of course, it's illegal. I mean, the FBI, they're being prosecuted for... it's interesting, the way federal crime works. It's very, very, very fascinating. There is no federal crime of murder. Murder is always a state thing. So if I murder somebody, but the feds want to get involved, the federal government wants to give me a bad sentence, so you technically get prosecuted for depriving someone of their civil rights. That's a federal crime. So technically, the theory is, well, if you're dead or you're castrated or whatever it is, you've been deprived of civil rights. So that's why you'll find that no matter what the person did, he'll always be prosecuted for depriving someone of their civil rights. That's because there is no, murder is not a federal crime. So the U.S. government, the FBI cannot get involved if it's just a murder. But if you call it deprivation of civil rights, they can get involved. Yeah.
When you say it basically needs a decree that you're kind to give a get,
That's an excellent question, which I didn't mention, and I'll mention it quickly. So the question you have to ask is, really, this is the $64,000 question, when is a Beis Din supposed to declare that a husband must give a get to his wife? So here, let me point out that this is a big machlokas, the Rambam and Rabbeinu Tam. According to the Rambam, which unfortunately for women we do not paskin like, but according to the Rambam, if a woman simply goes to a Beis Din and says, I cannot stand living with the guy anymore, that is all she has to do, and the Beis Din is supposed to order him to give a get, which means 100% of the time if she wants a divorce, she will be able to get that order. And the Rambam's language, which feminists like a lot because it is a very protective language of women, that a woman is not a shivcha, she is not a slave, that she could have intercourse with anybody who wants her. That's the Rambam. Rabbeinu Tam, however, is chaylik on the Rambam, and Rabbeinu Tam says, if a woman simply says, I can't stand living with him, that is not enough to order a man to give a get, because perhaps she wants to have an affair with somebody. She's just using this as an excuse to get out of a marriage. And therefore, according to Rabbeinu Tam, she would have to show something like physical abuse and the like between. And that's why it's a little difficult. The halacha is like Rabbeinu Tam, and I have to say that both the Shulchan Aruch and the Rambam, Ashkenazim and Sephardim, paskin like Rabbeinu Tam, which, by the way, is highly unusual, because 95% of the time, the Sephardim follow Rav Yosef Karo, as you know, and Rav Yosef Karo almost always paskins like the Rambam. So it's a very unusual situation where even Rav Yosef Karo does not follow the Rambam's view. So as a result, it is not so easy. In other words, it's not an automatic thing. And indeed, if you had just three guys who just say, yeah, she wants to get sure, that would not be a valid psak, and the goons would not be good. See, that's part of the problem with the rabbis. These rabbis claim, besides the FBI thing, these rabbis claim that they always convened a Beis Din first. They always had a Beis Din first that paskin, she's entitled to a get, and then they became the enforcers. It's like those tickets you get in the South, you know, the policeman, you know, gives you a ticket, and then he takes you to court, and then he puts on a robe, he becomes the judge, and then he sentences you to a night in jail, then he takes off the robe, and he becomes the jailer, you know. So it's like these rabbis were the Beis Din, and after they were the Beis Din, they became the goons. You know, they did both things. But I'll tell you the problem basically is that they were guaranteeing a psak. How do you guarantee a psak? If you give us $10,000, we will, I mean, how can they say ahead of time? And they didn't talk to the husband about it, you know. So even halachically, there's a real, real big question if these gittin were valid, because there was not a valid psak. But according to the Rambam, it would be very easy to get a psak. So certainly we're not talking about anybody can come together and issue a psak. Just to give you a number, again, agun is not our topic per se. I believe that of all the women who are filing for divorce in Eretz Yisrael, who are agunos, whose husbands are not giving them a get, only around 5% actually get an order that the husband must give a get. So it's not a huge thing. According to the Rambam, that number would be 100%. Because all you have to say is moisel. A woman doesn't have to prove anything. But as they say, the halacha is like Rabbeinu Tam. Rabbeinu Tam is, of course, Rashi's grandson. Okay. All right. Now, why am I bringing in Aguna? Because here's the point I want to make. The Maharal uses this idea to explain Paro, and he says the following. If it is true that every Jew, in their deep down recesses of their soul, really wants to keep Hashem's will, it is equally true that for someone like Paro, in the deep down recesses of his soul, doesn't want to obey Hashem. But what happened was, the Makos would have created an artificial pressure that would break his will and make him do what he really didn't want to do. So the Maharal says, when Hashem hardened Paro's heart, that was not an override of free will. That made him impervious to external pressure so he could make the decision he really wanted to make. You understand this? So if anything, Paro had more bechira than anybody in human history, because most of us, our choices are always affected by our externalities. Hashem made Paro so tough that Paro is not affected. You see the difference? Maharal is not learning Hashem took away Paro's choice. Rather, Hashem took away Paro's susceptibility to external pressure so that Paro could make the decision exactly as he wanted to make it. And therefore, the Maharal says, it's b'chlal not a kasha. Paro indeed exercised b'chira precisely because God hardened his heart, and therefore he made him resistant to pressure, right? So that's a very, very brilliant answer. But again, the Rambam's answer himself, the Rambam gives a different answer. I'm sorry, Thursday, one thing you have to leave early. What are we talking about? Okay. Let me just mention something very, very quickly. And then again, normally on Wednesday we started at 6. I was late today. I apologize. And that is, everybody asks the famous, I mean everybody, Rashi asks the famous question that, it's really from Chazal, that Hashem decrees that your children will be in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. Now we know that the Jews were only in Egypt for 210 years, so how can I say that there was a decree for 400 years? The answer that Rashi gives is that the Gezerah does not mean that the Jews are going to be in the land for 400 years, but it simply means your children, from the birth of your child, who is Yitzchak, who's going to be born when Abram is 100, until the exodus of Egypt, will be a period of 400 years, meaning we actually count the 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak. It's a famous Rashi, right? So 210 years in Egypt, but 400 years from the birth of Yitzchak. Now the question is, though, how can you possibly count 400 years from the birth of Israel? It says, your children will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and they will be slaves, and they will be afflicted 400 years. So the 400 years starts from slavery and affliction. How can you start it from the birth of Yitzchak? So the key is, and people often don't flesh this out, the key is to understand that if you read the Pasuk very, very carefully, the Pasuk actually describes three different stages that the Jewish people will experience. They will be strangers. That's Gerim. Gerim does not mean converts here. It means strangers. They will be slaves. They will be afflicted. These are not concurrent stages. These are sequential stages. Gerim is a sense of being an alien, a sense of being a stranger, a sense of not belonging. Slavery is more intense when you have servitude. And affliction is even worse. That's death and torture. That's one thing. Three stages. Moreover, the Torah does not mention the country Egypt. It says in a land that is not theirs. So the Pasuk doesn't mean there's going to be 400 years of slavery. Rather, it means over a period of 400 years, I'm just explaining what Rashi means by counting from the birth of Yitzchak, your children will experience three stages: being an alien, not being accepted, being a slave, and being physically tortured and afflicted. Now, the Torah does not tell me how long any of those stages is going to last. It just tells me that for 400 years, there will be three stages. So consequently, if you look at the life of Yitzchak Avinu, you can see that in Yitzchak Avinu's own lifetime, he was regarded as a stranger, even within the land of Israel. The Philistines, the Plishtim, would harass his people. They would fill up the wells. So consequently, a large part of that 400 years could actually be in Eretz Israel, because that was the aspect. We weren't slaves, but we were Gerim. We were like strangers. We were not treated as permanent residents. And then in Egypt started the slavery, and that was 210. Actually, even that, if you think about it, we weren't even slaves for 210 years, because what happened was Yaakov Avinu came to Eretz Israel, but Yaakov lived there for 17 years. And only after Yaakov died, and then the Shvatim died, and then Yosef, slavery did not start until after Yosef. So we were actually slaves around 100 years, not 210 years. And the persecution, which is the killing of the babies, was only the last 80 years or something. So that's a lot, but from the time of Moshe Rabbeinu's birth and the like. So you understand now, when we say we count from the birth of Yitzchak, that's because we're interpreting that they don't have to be slaves for that time. They just have to go through being a stranger, Geirus Av Sinai, and that could be maskil even in Eretz Yisrael. Right? That's the approach of Rashi, in which there is no contradiction between the 210 and the 400. They are measuring different things. Now, other Midrashim, we'll talk about this tomorrow, other Midrashim have an approach that Hashem did decree 400, but in his rachamim, he cut it down. That's a different approach. Rashi is not learning there was a change in decree. Rashi is learning that the decree itself enabled 400 years from the birth of Yisrael. Okay? So we'll continue tomorrow. You have a good evening.